Good morning, and thank you for attending today's program, which is sponsored by the Librarians Association of the University of California, Berkeley Research and Professional Development Committee. My name is Terry Huey, librarian at the Institute of Industrial Relations and member of the committee. Our program today is entitled The State of Library and Information Services at the University of California, Berkeley. In planning the program, the committee felt that it would be an opportune moment to invite Jerry Lowell, our recently appointed university librarian, to comment on the dynamic environment of academic information services that we're all confronted with. On further reflection, we thought that it would also be an excellent opportunity to invite other information managers and academics from around the campus to join Jerry in reflecting on the challenges and opportunities that libraries are confronted with. With that in mind, we have assembled a roster of speakers who are each distinguished in their own right. Our first speaker is Jerry Lowell. Prior to being appointed at Berkeley, Jerry was Associate Vice Chancellor, Academic Information Technology, and University Librarian at UC San Diego. Prior to being appointed at UC San Diego, Jerry was Associate University Librarian and Director for Technical Services at Yale. Our second speaker will be Jack McCready. Jack is Associate Vice Chancellor, Information Systems and Technology. Prior to his appointment in 1992, he was Group Engineering Manager for Corporate Research at the Digital Equipment Corporation. From 1980 through 1984, he was President of EDUCOM. Before joining EDUCOM, he was Vice Provost for Information Systems and Planning at Carnegie Mellon University. Our third and final speaker is Bob Behring. None of these people need an introduction, but some of you might work in the library. I thought it would be a good idea. Bob is law librarian and professor at Bolt Hall, where he holds the Walter Perry Johnson Chair. He has been associated with Bolt Hall since 1982. From 1986 through 1989, he was dean of the School of Library and Information Studies here at Berkeley. He won the Distinguished Teaching Award in 1987, and he has written and spoken widely on the future of libraries and information. There will be a single question period that will follow all three presentations at the end, so hold your questions. At that time, you'll be invited to direct them to each speaker as you choose to. Please join me in welcoming our first speaker, Jerry Lowell.
Well, I hope that you all like Monday mornings better than I do. This is how my day started. I'm at the BART stop, having arrived at Berkeley, and I thought I needed to add more money to my BART card. And stupidly, I opened my briefcase up, and it's fat because of all my weekend papers, and I set my BART ticket right on top of this open briefcase, rummaging around in my billfold trying to find more money, and of course, three BART trains go by, and by the time I remember that I need to find my BART ticket, it has long gone somewhere. It's flown away. So I go upstairs and beg mercy from this guardian of the gates, and she said, "Oh, it was okay, it happened all the time." She was actually very nice, so I'm fine. So I then spent five more minutes with this new technology of this machine trying to feed my $5 bill in it, wouldn't go in. Get to work, sit down at my desk, open my eyeglass case, and there's my BART ticket inside my eyeglass case. I'm going to pretend that it really wasn't there, that it was on top of that briefcase. I'm not going to talk about what I'm supposed to talk about. I want to talk about something different. So you're all going to sit now with your feet firmly on the floor. You're going to put your hands on your knees. Things are great. Things are great. Things are great. I'm going to say that for 20 minutes. I'm going to finish up my talk and turn over to these other two august gentlemen who are following me. Instead of focusing specifically on new technologies or focusing on the technology itself, I really have decided instead to focus more on the process of adopting or adapting to new technologies and what the organization needs to go through and what the organization faces as we look at new technologies. I think that all of you and certainly the august other individuals on this panel can talk circles around me about the technologies themselves and what they have to offer, this specific technology or that specific technology. Instead, I'm going to look at the organizational dynamic. Most of you know that that's one of my keen interests, and therefore I decided to focus on that. I'm going to do broad brush comments. I'm going to oversimplify. I'm going to make gross generalizations. Bob has already told me he's going to shoot me down, so I figured I might as well let him know all this ahead of time. So I'm preparing the landscape, you see, for what's to come. Every one of my statements is undefendable. And all that I hope is that we generate lively discussion when we finish, when we get to the Q&A session. So let's turn to, first of all, how well are we adapting to new technologies? Certainly from many perspectives, the UC libraries as a system are doing an admirable job. I think if we look back historically, Melville has been a wonderful success. It's certainly now dated, but when it was first adapted and as it rolled out, it was an international model. The California Digital Library has served as, again, a national and international model, and in its short period of existence has certainly addressed some of the key challenges that we face regarding especially electronic journals and now e-scholarship. As we turn to the Berkeley Library as a system, the broad library system, we have certainly played an important leadership role in addressing new technologies. Our work on EAD that led to the Online Archive of California, our work on metadata standards, the Bancroft Library's digitization work, the Berkeley Library Sunsite developments, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There is a long list of technologically keen initiatives and innovations that we have introduced. But I think we can certainly do much more. We've just scratched the surface, and clearly we are Berkeley, and therefore we must do much more. And where does that then lead us? I thought I would share with you all about six factors that I think dramatically affect our ability to adapt to new technologies. And also then to make a few comments about how well I think we are addressing those specific factors. The first factor I'm just calling campus consensus, that the new technologies, however defined, offer promise and are worth the risk and investment. And as we look at many of these technological developments, we are not a campus that reflects broad consensus about new technologies in general. I think instead we are quite fractionated. The landscape, unfortunately, continues to be polarized. And we almost have guerrilla warfare at times between print versus electronic, between traditional versus electronic. And I think these false dichotomies continually then put roadblocks in our way as we push forward. One of the topics I think illustrates this is the topic of educational technology. And this clearly is, from my perspective, an arena where we do not have consensus on this campus across academia regarding what educational technology means and what it offers within the classroom. We can't even figure out yet how to structure our administrative organization to deal with educational technology. We have had numerous committees struggle with the issue. We have a temporary solution in place at the present time, and we have much work to be done. And I ask myself, you know, why is that we can't get our act together? And I think it's the case that many of the faculty in key roles here remain skeptical of technological innovation within the classroom, of distance learning methodologies, of computer-based instruction. And I think this distrust is heightened when you have Office of the President individuals and state legislature individuals who, from a top-down perspective, wish to introduce such technological innovation as a cost-cutting measure, as a productivity increaser, or as a way to deal with Tidal Wave 2, which just reinforces, I think, the fire for the traditionalists on campus regarding educational technology. The governance structures within the Academic Senate, I think, are by nature conservative. They're established to reduce risk, and I think any group process tends to, I think, diminish innovation and creativity. I then ask myself, how dramatically can a large and complex service organization, such as the library, with its wide range of constituencies, push broad adaptation of new technologies when there is such risk involved? The second factor affecting our ability to adapt to new technologies, I think, is the continual conflict between attempting to provide exceptional operational support services and a desire to redirect some of these resources to conduct basic or applied research and to apply in an alpha or beta sort of environmental test mode. And I think we clearly see this conflict played out right now, with especially in the Berkeley Library System. Who should get new positions and why? Should we be investing in metadata librarians, or should we be investing in staff to work circulation desks? Should we be spending valuable time improving stack management within the Garter stacks? Should we be spending valuable time digitizing resources? Should we be spending valuable time worrying about digital archiving of material that is only born digital? Who should make those resource allocation decisions? What processes should we follow as we attempt to make those decisions? And can any group process promote and manage dynamic risk-taking ventures? That issue of group process and creativity is one that really has seen me change over the years, especially in San Diego when we really focused on group process. One of the things that struck me was whether broad group involvement can manage and organize and work around risk-taking ventures, because I think the group by definition wants to remove all that risk and make something be really safe. And so that's a question I think that we need to struggle with. That issue leads to the third factor, and that is our ability to work together and our ability to take risks within our own environment. I think we're making, certainly within the Berkeley Library System that I administer, we're making great strides in addressing the issue of our working environment, but we have much that remains to be done, especially if we want to be an organization that values risk, that learns from mistakes, and supports each other as we explore these brave new initiatives and the new technologies that accompany them. Another factor is our ability to work together across campus lines. It struck me my first year here as an outsider that Berkeley doesn't appear to be a campus that prides itself much on wonderful collegial working relationships with other institutions within UC and without. It is clearly very inbred, and I think must begin to change its methods if it wishes to be an innovator. We have a very complex relationship, for example, and sometimes distrustful relationship with CDL. This clearly needs to be improved, I think, as we push forward. Critically important, I think, for us as a campus to recognize, I think we're already recognizing, but that we've got to do something and do something now about our administrative infrastructure. Because without a smooth operating infrastructure, we can't take and launch these technological developments that we wish to launch. A fifth factor affecting our ability to adapt to new technologies is our ability to muster sufficient financial and human resources to devote to the introduction of new technologies and new technology-based programs and services. I needn't tell any of you in this room that we are woefully underfunded for the type of information library system and organization that currently exists at Berkeley. I think we're making progress. We got new money last year, about $525,000 of permanent money from the state legislature. We expect to get that much again this coming fiscal year. But even with those increases, I fear that we do not have sufficient money to support operationally the number of diverse libraries that we have across campus, and we are then going to face, I think, some very serious choices. It's important for us to face those choices because I do believe that we should be a technological innovator for the nation, for the world, and we need to make sure we have those resources to be able to muster to play that leadership role. As we look at sufficient financial human resources, another area is our current workforce. We are seeing dramatic changes in our workforce. We have many more types of computing and technology-based positions than we had a decade ago, and we'll continue to see growing diversity in this area. With that diversity comes continued challenges and special challenges of recruitment and retention as we compete with Silicon Valley, with technology startups and such. People don't become instant millionaires by selling their stock when they work at the Berkeley Library. The last factor that I want to mention is courageous leadership and hard work at a whole variety of levels throughout the organization. We have always had to make choices. We've always had to make hard choices. We've always had difficult choices in front of us. But I think we are going to face more and more of those as we attempt to figure out how best to allocate our resources and how best to figure out where we want to make our mark in the technological arena. Let me turn to another question, and that is, how will even newer technologies, curricular changes, public policy, affect information services and libraries at Berkeley in the coming years? I have a few, three observations I'd like to make regarding this point. This is obviously not a complete list, but these are the three that are intriguing issues for me in my position. What's fascinating for me in the first comment is to elaborate more on the conflict between units and principals on campus in a variety of these issues. I think about Elsevier, the library's perspective toward Elsevier, and certain of our faculty's perspectives toward Elsevier. We are not in sync. We in the library think everybody shares our view, and there are many on campus who don't share that view regarding Elsevier as publisher. And that conflict applies also into our technological and innovative sorts of arenas. We have that same conflict in copyright, intellectual property rights. One camp of us on campus believes regarding copyright is not shared by another portion of campus. We have a very interesting issue now arising within the state legislature with the introduction of the bill to require that faculty-developed curricula emerging from the new technological environment be owned by the faculty. And that's a very fascinating phenomenon to watch the legislature take action and demanding that something happen within CSU and expecting that UC Board of Regents will follow suit. Other operational issues, I think, generate interesting dichotomies for us at the present time where all of us are working from good intention and we end up with interesting perspectives. I don't know if Jack's going to talk about iDrive, but let me just mention briefly a wonderful development on this campus for students and faculty to have access to large amounts of storage on hard disk, which is truly a benefit. It's a service that we need. Another unit on this campus, the library, has large numbers of electronic contracts for electronic information that prohibit off-site downloaded storage of massive amounts of data. So how do we merge those two different perspectives together? What are our various roles? The issue of role definition, I think, leads to a second point I'd like to make, and that is that right now we are in an immensely gray and very murky area of technological law, of technological policy, and it's very difficult to even figure out what we should be doing when in certain of these very murky areas. One example is the iDrive implementation. Should we ask for legal advice from a campus council, or do we avoid asking, knowing that we won't like the answer anyway, and knowing if we went to two different counselors, we'd get two different answers? I remember at UCSD when I was there, and I had a different role at UCSD, when we were attempting to figure out what rights and responsibilities a student had who was using UCSD computing equipment to host a listserv for a political campaign for one of the House of Representatives races. And this individual was allied with a very liberal candidate in La Jolla, not the bastion of liberaldom, and a very influential local representative calls up and says, "What in the hell are you doing allowing university resources and this website being posted on printed materials that says, you know, students for candidate X?" And I was supposed to respond to this legislator. Well, I asked about eight different people. We had a policy in place. I asked eight different people, got eight different answers, eight conflicting answers. And luckily, the student graduated and had left the campus. So I can't tell you for sure what the policy would still have been. And luckily, it avoided itself because the student left. Another example, I have faculty who told me, "I don't believe in the copyright law, and therefore I'm not going to follow it. And I will post what I want to post on my website. Thank you very much." That's an interesting dilemma when you have a faculty address this in that fashion and tell you, "Just not going to do it. Thank you." And then finally, a few comments about public policy vis-a-vis technology. I don't know what it's going to mean for us as we continue to push forward with technological development within our libraries and on campus, when we have a state legislature that believes that all of the intellectual resources and all the developments related to information management should be available to all of the citizenry of the state. We have a university president who firmly believes that now. The California Digital Library has been positioned to be that entity for the state of California. We have money folks within OP who firmly believe that everything is going digital. We no longer need to build libraries. And those individuals also have support within the state legislature. And if our capital programs need to go through OP, what does that mean for us as we look at technology and technological development in this same sort of venue? We have individuals within OP who believe that one copy of a title within the entire library is quite satisfactory. And that's an interesting issue for us right now as we look at technology and JSTOR and ask questions. Why do we all need to keep print copies of all of these back files of the titles in JSTOR when they are all available electronically? And that's a very difficult question when you start getting into such stupid things as measuring volume counts for ARL rankings. And by discarding titles, you reduce your ARL rankings when you're trying, in fact, to take advantage of the technological innovations that are afforded because of the JSTOR product in the first place. We have some faculty on this campus who passionately believe that there should be only two research libraries, one here and one at UCLA, and that all the other campuses should use the resources of these two libraries. Certainly technological innovation would make all that possible, but is that the appropriate path for us to pursue from a policy perspective? Let me just conclude my formal remarks. As most of you know, I thoroughly enjoy the Q&A sessions much more than formal remarks, so I'm going to save some of my allotted 20 minutes for Q&A. But I don't want you to leave this morning thinking that I am negative in raising any of these questions or concerns. Quite the contrary. I think it's an extraordinarily exciting time, and we are witnessing major transitions. There aren't answers. It's not clear where we're going. It's quite difficult even to plan, because by the time you get an adequate plan in place, there is yet another technological innovation that has replaced three generations out from the one you're trying to plan for. There are vast roadblocks, vast challenges. We can't get bills paid right now. The chair that I ordered a year ago is still not in. So, you know, there are other issues that put all this in perspective. But it's clear that we are all going to be required to deal with ambiguity, with risk, with uncertainty. We will continue to have extraordinarily difficult choices in front of us, and if we view it as win and lose situations, then we're going to have winners and we're going to have losers. So clearly we can't view it as a win and lose situation. We will have choices to make, we will make those choices, and I hope that we find a way to continue to move forward as an organization so that all of us are challenged with this new environment and having a great time while we do it. Thank you much.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here and talk about the state of information services on the Berkeley campus with you. I can't say that I've had as rocky a Monday morning as you have, Jerry, but 17 crazy years have passed since I edited a book called Campus Computing Strategies, the monograph that initiated the EDUCON strategy series on information technology. In 1983, when we did this book, planners on the 10 campuses involved did not foresee the World Wide Web or the tremendous growth of electronic commerce in their future. Nor did we recognize the influence that Microsoft would certainly exert over every aspect of our environments. Few knew that four employees that year had incorporated to form Sun Microsystems, and fewer still would have predicted at that date that Digital Equipment Corporation, DEC, would no longer exist as an independent corporation in 1998. I'm sure we see into the next two decades no better now than we did in 1983. Colleges and universities are responsible for transmitting humanity's accumulated knowledge and wisdom to the next generation, expanding our knowledge base, teaching about it, distributing it as widely as possible, and certainly preserving it. And the central and ever-expanding role for information technologies in these endeavors creates a very strong imperative us to formulate appropriate strategies for developing a rich and robust set of integrated information services that are tailored to Berkeley's unique education and research environment. The World Wide Web, the Internet, ubiquitous personal computing and communications devices have already changed the ways people throughout the world gain access to information and the ways that we interact with each other. These technologies are changing how we learn, how we do research, how we manage our activities, how we reach out to others, and even how we have fun. Planners and IT professionals may speculate about the revolutionary effects these advances are going to spawn during the coming two decades, but we will probably underestimate the actual impacts by large amounts, and we will certainly misjudge the timing of these significant changes. Our planning efforts today are unlikely to predict exactly when or how emerging high-performance networks such as Internet 2 and CalRAN 2 and these pervasive wireless personal digital assistants or campus portholes will actually change higher education. Now, one way of getting at this is to have an effective IT planning process, one that helps people on campus try to understand the appropriate roles for information technologies in learning and research, outreach, management, and how to predict how these things might change over time. And Jerry set the stage for many of the complex issues that are driving the complexities around doing good plans in these areas. A well-designed planning process enables IT organizations and other campus departments with which it works, all of you in the libraries, to develop a shared understanding of how technology can and should support specific programs. The process should include ways of communicating these strategies throughout the broad organization. Where should technology be introduced? Where should a smoothly running process be left alone? And in short, we and the entire campus community should begin to understand what it means at Berkeley to become a technologically wise organization. Planning for Information Systems and Technology at UC Berkeley 1999 to 2003 is IST's most recent strategic plan working in these areas. We completed this plan last spring. And in it, we had an explicit description of IST's focus for the next several years as a central element of this. Now, this was a broad set of focus on certain major issues, not operational plans. The strategies outline what we will focus on, not the detailed plans of how we're going to try to accomplish these objectives. The strategic plan reflects customer input, working with other organizations. In fact, we had a senior library representative on that process from the beginning. And what we're trying to do there is to set the bounds on which our managers are going to make day-to-day decisions over the next several years. And that plan is on the web, if you haven't seen it already, in the IST section there. IST's overarching strategies are providing IT leadership, building the information technology infrastructure, and expanding IT technical support. And these overall strategies, as I say, are what guide our operational budget requests each year and our current set of plans that we bring forward. And Jerry mentioned a new one, for example, the iDrive initiative. Well, as we look through this planning process, we identified several major challenges that face the campus. And I'd like to mention a couple of those because they currently are still unresolved and still major challenges. And they really impact what we're talking about today, the state of information services on the campus. And the first of those Jerry already mentioned, not surprisingly at all, and that is there's a major resource mismatch between what the campus really wants in these areas and what it is able to fund currently. Campus departments need significantly more technical support, for example, than they now have. And in order to attract and retain the best researchers, teachers, students, and administrative staff, we've got to have competitive information services throughout all of our environments. And in order to invest in these new technologies, strategies are needed to either reallocate existing resources or to develop additional resources. And I think all units are working in both of those dimensions, trying to get more and trying to figure out ways of taking what they have and spreading them around in better ways. Second major challenge is that we really have uneven educational technologies throughout most of the departments and goals in these areas. And again, Jerry mentioned this same idea. We just have different views of how we should use educational technologies to really support and to supplement the processes that we have well underway. Frequently, existing services that we have are not well coordinated and are really difficult to locate and access. In addition, they're not evenly distributed among disciplines, and many have-not departments have trouble even beginning to experiment with these new applications. As Jerry mentioned, we have a new process in place on campus to try to focus attention on those, with Alice Igagino serving as a faculty assistant to Carol to really work those issues, and I think we're making some really good progress in trying to define how to move forward better in this whole area. The third challenge is really directly related to all of us in the room today, and that is, how do we support emerging digital libraries in this environment? Berkeley faces the enormous challenge of integrating the classic paper and artifact-based systems of libraries and museums with all of the emerging electronic systems. And so how do we do that in a reasonable way is requiring us to get effective partnerships among libraries, museums, and IT organizations. And partnerships are there right now, but they're weak, and they're not really being pushed as hard as they need to be if we're going to really make progress in this area. Fourth major challenge is an aging infrastructure. Administrative systems certainly come to mind. We're trying to replace a bunch of them, but we do not have infrastructures in place at all for a billion-plus organization, which is what this campus just is. We don't know how to pay the bills, order the stuff, pay people, and do things efficiently on the campus. And so trying to regenerate this aging administrative structure is certainly something that everybody is working very hard on, with a lot more path that we've got to travel down that path to get there. The networking infrastructure, unfortunately, in many cases is very old and needs to be replaced. And in other cases, it's pretty modern and working well, but it's uneven throughout the campus, and in many areas, it really is aging, and we do not have yet a funding model in place to really take care of the network and to bring it up to modern standards in the areas where it is where it's pretty old. I've been here now 7 years, and when I got here, we had approximately 7,000 nodes on the network. This past summer, we passed over 35,000 active connections on the network. Now, when you grow by a factor of 5 in 7 years, you are really growing and pushing stuff. The problem with all of that is that the stuff that was there originally, that 7,000 nodes, is now 7 and 8 years old, and we don't have the process in place to be able to fix the old parts of the network, and there's no structure in place to do that. So we've been on a process of building new and not taking care of old, and as the old begins to rotten, become dysfunctional, we're getting into problems in that area. So that is a major problem. And perhaps the worst problem as far as the infrastructure goes is one that you probably don't know much about, and that is that the Computing and Communications Center for the campus that I manage, and it really is the interaction point with all of the outside networks and everything, is in the basement of Evans Hall, a seismically poor building, and a building that had a very poor operations center before it was rated seismically poor. That was just one final nail into the coffin. So we've been working on that now for 4 years and making glacially slow progress in moving forward in that area. And as we have floods, as we did this summer, with water mains bursting and water pouring into the basement, short-circuiting major transformers and almost killing several members of our staff, as we've had fires in the building, on and on and on, all we need now are locusts and pestilence. It's a real major problem, and we're working on it very hard. I finally lost my cool after about 4 years of working on the problem this fall, and blew up at a campus computing and policy meeting about it, and we seem to have some motion now on it. Gaining the estimate of when it'll be done, given the current progress over the last 4 years, is about 3 centuries. So that clearly won't work. So we are trying some new approaches and all of that. Another whole major challenge is the whole e-business area. What do we mean by e-commerce? What do we mean by e-business and e-scholarship and all these kinds of things? Academic content delivery, distance education, outreach, all of these activities. Jerry mentioned several of them also, but one of the key things impeding us in these areas is the whole issue around policies and procedures in these areas. Copyright, reimbursement of people, ownership, all of these activities are there. We just went through a major exercise on the campus evaluating the UCOP, new proposed electronic communications policy. Many advances in that policy over the earlier electronic mail policy, but clearly many gaps left in that, and many of you responded to that, and for those responses, I thank you. They've all been sent off to Office of the President, and they are looking over all of this input that they got from the administrative review from all of the campuses, and probably will have a revised policy out this spring, and I urge all of us to really go back and really look at that. It's one of the key things that will drive this entire evolution. And the final challenge I'd like to mention is retaining, recruiting, and retraining information technology professionals across the campus. It's a major problem that we have, and we've been making some progress on it. We've been taking things to the state legislature and to the regents, and there have been IT parity increases and some things that have been coming down, but right now we still have major problems in this area, and whenever we go out on a national or even a regional search, it just makes it really clear how big a problem that we really have in competing and in new job markets and in retaining our excellent staff that we have. Now, we also have some major opportunities, and all of us know from listening to Chancellor Tian that the Chinese word for crisis is this mixture of opportunity and crisis and challenge that we have. So every one of the challenges, as I've talked about, could also be looked at as an opportunity, and they certainly are looked that way. But in addition, I think we have some additional opportunities that are there, and I'd just like to mention here three major opportunities that we have that are related. The first one is what I call defining and implementing a technologically wise university. There is no one definition for this that really fits every institution, and there's certainly not one definition that we know of that fits Berkeley right now. So it's a work in progress, and we really must move on this, trying to understand how do we use technology for this campus at this particular point in time, given the economic constraints that we have. I mean, all these things come together, and given the views of many of the faculty that are out there, that some are skeptical, as Jerry mentioned, some are true innovators, and many are just searching, trying to find what are the right set of activities for their classes, for their research, for their scholarship. This is a big problem for us and a great opportunity to try to understand that. And one of the challenges that we have that is not particularly an IT challenge, but that Jerry mentioned very briefly, is Tidal Wave 2. And this has been written about recently in the Berkeleyan and a really good description of it. This campus is going to get off relatively easy in that our goal of new students is only 4,000 students, which is about a little less than a 15% increase. But for a campus that has an agreed upon long-range development plans that say that our headcount will actually shrink and that our facilities are capped where they are, this is a pretty big challenge of how to get there. The opportunity around this, I think, is that it is going to cause us to really start thinking outside of the box of how we do this. And I think technology has to play some kind of a role in this whole set of solutions. And I've been somewhat surprised that early on most of the solutions look at where can we build another dorm and how can we use another physical space someplace else, rather than getting in and really trying to grapple with the area of what role, if any, does technology play in this. I think it does play a role, and it's a great opportunity for helping to solve a major problem that we have about understanding that role and really getting about it. Another major opportunity is the California Digital Library. Again, Jerry mentioned it briefly, and I think it's a real opportunity for this campus and for the entire system. I think it's taking a leadership role throughout the country in looking at ways of integrating electronic journals and resources along with all of the paper-based activities that we've been dealing with. And I was surprised to learn recently at one of the advisory committee meetings of the CDL in which I sit that we now have over 5,000 journals online, and that's rapidly increasing, including new collections from JSTOR and so on. We're building and sharing and preserving collections also as part of that, supporting innovation in scholarly communications, creating tools and services, and for that, some of these tools and services are directly technological barriers, such as how to deal with solid electronic authentication of who is on the end of the line asking for stuff. So we've built a common authentication project across all 10 campuses. And trying to implement that and bring that in so that one of the tools that the CDL can actually use. So these things are really great opportunities for us as we develop strategic partnerships in this area. And I think building on the great history that we all understand going back with Melville and others, that California and Berkeley really has a tremendous opportunity to do some exciting things in that area. And the third really exciting opportunity that I'd like to mention for us today to consider is the CalREN2 network that is now built, and its cousin or sibling or whatever you want to call it, the overall Internet 2 set of activities throughout the country. We have an organization in California called CNIC, the Corporation for Education Networking Infrastructure in California. And I serve as a vice chair of the board of CNIC, and we just had a board meeting last Friday, and I think every time I meet with these folks, it really encourages me about where this is going and the opportunities that we have. So I've actually brought you a little handout. If you could pass those out for me, Terry. We have a new brochure. It's really new, so the ink might be a little wet. I just picked these up at the meeting last week, and I'm pleasantly surprised at how many people are here today, so I don't know if I have enough of these. If I don't, just send an email to me with your address, and I'll send them over to you in campus mail, or you can swing by my office in 209 Evans Hall. I brought back plenty of these to hand out and over the campus over the next several weeks, and try to get people to understand really what CNIC really is. Briefly, the exciting thing about it from an organizational standpoint is that it is a partnership of the three major segments in higher education activities around in California. For example, we have the entire CSU system as a founding member of it, all 22 campuses, and the UC is another founding member of it. And then the privates, major privates are there. We have Stanford, Caltech with the Jet Propulsion Lab as its affiliate, and the University of Southern California with its affiliate, the Information Sciences Institute, also there. In addition, we have major corporate affiliates that have started it. Our four major partners are Sun Microsystems, IBM, PacBell, and Cisco. And this is a similar kind of a collaboration that goes on in many parts of the country as the overall goal of Internet 2. We have regional networks like CalREN in many parts of the country. Given the size and complexity of California, CalREN is certainly one of the largest. We have now completed the first and partial second phase of actually building the network. It now exists. There's a major infrastructure here in Northern California. For those of you that are interested in some of the techie parts of that, you can take a look in the brochure. It'll explain parts of that, but we do have OC48 connectivity in the north and OC48 connectivity in the south, and we are planning and will install this spring a major north-south link that'll connect those two major hubs. They're currently connected, but in a relatively bizarre way. They're connected through Internet 2 using the Abilene network and the VBNS network, and interestingly enough, the way you right now get to UCLA or San Diego through that network is you leave out of Evans Hall from the northern Gigapop and connect out to Denver on the Abilene network, and then from Denver down to Southern California. And so this spring there will be a north-south route that will go down through the valley that will link up our 10th campus in Merced also and pick up several more of the CSU campuses. And then in the plans are a coastal north-south link also for redundancy. Now, This network is not just an experimental set of activities in high bandwidth areas, but an operational network that is today carrying all of the bits. UC has gotten rid of our network. We don't have UCNet anymore. We've moved everything over onto CalRAN. So if you are using any kind of services among campuses, you're using it using over CalRAN at this stage, and it still has plenty of capacity for experimental high bandwidth kinds of activities and high bandwidth delivery of materials of the kind that we're talking about, images and biomedical applications and all of the research activities around libraries are clearly what this network's all about, and it's a great opportunity for us. In summary, Professor Dyson of the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, proclaimed in his 1998 Chautauqua lecture that genetic engineering, solar power, and the internet will be the three most important technologies of the coming century. Certainly, information technologies are already transforming both society and higher education. Just think back a little bit. The IBM PC was introduced only 19 years ago. The Apple Macintosh 16 years ago. The commercial commodity internet about 10 years ago, and the World Wide Web only about 6 or 7 years ago. Technologies fueling advances like these are continued to emerge at breakneck speed, and clearly, Berkeley's and all of higher education's ability to incorporate these tools and realize their full potential is still in its very infancy. Who can forecast exactly what these effects of these challenges will bring? Perhaps Professor Dyson's crystal ball gazing, looking a full century ahead, will not stand the test of time at all. However, the internet and related technologies are certainly going to spawn some of the most important advances of the coming decade. So our questions are, how will UC Berkeley adapt to an era of electronic activities in which every person is going to have vast amounts of information available at the touch of a keyboard? High-quality distance learning, intelligent tutoring programs, electronic libraries, virtual classrooms, high-bandwidth economical communication, and competition from for-profit corporations are speculations of what's going to be out there and applications that are really pretty much right over the horizon. Clearly, we need creative thinkers at all of our levels to develop the winning strategies we need to enable us to remain a truly great university throughout the transformation that's already underway. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to thank Lock for the opportunity to be here to hear these two very interesting presentations. I almost feel like I should skip my speech and go right to questions. But I do reflect upon the beginning of each of our speakers. I loved Jerry's description of the difficulty of working with the BART ticket machinery, which shows that although you can develop large-scale systems for moving huge amounts of three-dimensional objects around, we still all end up down on our knees with our attaché cases open, scrabbling for quarters. And I also think it's nice that Jack brought us a bunch of brochures straight from the printers with the ink still wet to share information with us. So it's an illustration of, I guess, my text for today, which was written by Ray Davies in the song Lola, "What a Mixed Up, Muddled Up World This Is." Because we are standing here today discussing items which are flowing around us and make it very difficult to make calculated judgments for today and good plans for tomorrow. What I want to do is talk about three basic premises that I think we have to recognize inform everything that we talk about. Then I want to speculate a little bit about Berkeley and its future. The first I'm not going to say a great deal about because we all know about it, but we cannot ignore it. And the first premise is that the culture in which we live is changing. The very environment around us is shifting, and we can't tell exactly how that's happening. We certainly can't tell with any accuracy where that's going. Listening to the two speakers before me with the wide range of objectives that are underway is a fantastic illustration of that. And we don't control it. Employees do leave the library system and found their own companies now. Corporations in the world are changing the environment in which we work. At one time, I think that the information producers at great universities like this one retained some control, not all control, but some control over information production and distribution. We never varied into the popular culture area with any regularity, but scholarly communication, discussion of certain types of issues stayed within our purview, and that is just not the case anymore. We have private companies bringing us initiatives. We have private and public joint venturing initiatives. It's very difficult to tell what's going on. I watched the Super Bowl yesterday. I think of yesterday as sort of a national holiday these days. This is our national football day. And I think, like many people, one of the things I wanted to see, I am a sports fan from way back, I admit it, but I wanted to see the commercials. I mean, we all want to see the commercials. And I could not keep track. At the end of the program, I know they're actually taking an online poll. You can go and vote what was the most effective commercial. I could remember some of the commercials. I couldn't remember the addresses of many of the companies, let alone what they did. And it struck me that I am not a techno cowboy, but I am not an uninformed couch potato either. So that the fact that even I couldn't keep track of what some of them were about, and I guess that was the whole point. My favorite commercial was the one from E-Trade, which had the 30 wasted seconds. The people just listened to the radio, and they said, well, we just wasted $2 million. what are you doing with your money? That I remember. But as the culture shifts around us, it puts us in an incredibly difficult position. And the one what it relates most to is there's two ends of this problem. The one end is the corporate sector, which is moving so fast. And I've been here 18 years now, and I have seen those waves, those moments when we here at the university think, you know what, we can play this game. I remember when we tried to market the university library, when we thought we can sell our information, we can make a lot of money. We cannot do that. That's why we're here. We are protected from the outside. We can think great thoughts, we can play, but we are not entrepreneurs. And in fact, the old style entrepreneurs from 18 years ago aren't even entrepreneurs anymore. It's an entirely different business culture, and you know, you can go up to Haas and talk about it, but we can't play that game. But they are having an enormous impact on us. And the impact is on the other side, and that is what I think of as our customers, our consumers, the students who come here are arriving with a level of sophistication in their demands for information that it's very hard for us to meet. And talking to students, and I teach a large undergraduate course and I teach an undergraduate seminar, one of the reasons being I want to keep at students, and a lot of the issues in the seminar I talk about are cognitive authority. I want to find out, you know, it's not a scientific sample, but I don't want to just rely on my own children for what's going on in the world. And you can see, talking to them, that Henry Ford was right. History is bunk. They don't care. They don't care about the struggles of the last 20 years. They don't care about the problems of the infrastructure. All they know is what they want. For many years, one of my favorite movies has been Key Largo, the Humphrey Bogart classic, in which he goes down to a hotel in the Florida Keys to deliver the bad news to Lauren Bacall about her husband dying. He was a war buddy. But the point of the story then is Edward G. Robinson is introduced as a really awful character. He is the antagonist who stands for all that's wrong with life. And at one point, Bogart tries to prod him, tries to get him to go over the top. And he says, the guy's name is Johnny Rocco. And he says, Johnny Rocco, what do you want? And Edward G. Robinson snarls at him, I want more. And he says, and have you ever had enough, Johnny? He said, no, I've never had enough. And I was struck dumb a few months ago when I saw a commercial. I mean, maybe you know this commercial, where it shows a woman on a stair. You know, she's working on one of those machines. And she's talking on a phone, and then it plays back, and she has a bunch of assistants, and it plays back further, and she's actually in a fantastic penthouse office, and it plays back further, and she's the head of a huge corporation, and someone says, what is it that you really want? And she looks at the camera and says, I want more. And I realize we have transmogrified from Johnny Rocco in Key Largo to a successful role model of today. But that's what our students want. They simply want more. They want better. They want that bandwidth. I don't know that they want it for scholarly interchange. But they want it so that Pamela Anderson is three-dimensional. I mean, they want it. And that we have no control. We have no control over the private sector. We have no control over that sector. And I don't think, you know, we all know, yeah, it's changing, but you just can't, at every meeting, you have to reinforce the fact that in that sense, our fate is not within our own hands. The culture is changing around us. And it's a huge cultural shift. And if you've heard me or if you've read my stuff, you know that I talk a lot about this. Second major factor, though, is this is Berkeley. And we are, I assume, everyone here is in some way connected with the university, with its library system, with its information infrastructure. This is a unique and interesting place in many ways. At its most basic, Berkeley is a fiercely independent institution. I've come to believe over the years that frequently if you examine institutions and the arc of their life, they vary enormously from the original intent. They don't end up being what they were. A book that I gave a lot of folks for Christmas was Nicholas Lehman's The Big Test, which was a book about the origin of testing in this country. It has a fantastic history of the Educational Testing Service, and none of them intended the SAT to be used the way it is. That isn't what they thought they were doing. But it became, now that's what they think they're doing, because that's the thing today. But Berkeley, actually, if you read the Examiner yesterday, they had a nice piece in the Examiner magazine about the founding of Berkeley and the founding of Stanford and what they were after. And in the Big Test, there's a really excellent section on the University of California. And really, this is an intentional development. Clark Kerr and the folks who worked with him wanted to build a great research university that was attached to a public institution which still had teaching duties. And that is an incredible mix of intents and motives that has to be carried out. So we have a problem there, but the dynamic energy produced by those different mixed goals has made Berkeley what it is today. One of the things that has made Berkeley so powerful is the independence of its faculty. I completely agree with Jerry. The Academic Senate is an inherently conservative institution. We were talking a little bit about university structure before the program began. I teach about China. That's my other area. And the University of California often reminds me of court life in ancient China, because there's so much ritual. There are so many counselors who have to be met. I mean, maybe if we could get everybody together, we'd all say, yes, we want the dynasty to prosper. But there's so much fighting and infighting and committee work that goes to getting from point A to point B. And you can spend so much time. I've always been convinced there are buildings full of people on this campus who do nothing other than talk to other people in buildings on this campus. They're totally divorced from the students, from the faculty, from the delivery of information services, like we do in the libraries. But the faculty's independence has maintained itself. I mean, through all of this, we are an extremely idiosyncratic bunch. And we are right now spread all over the map. And I'm not going to reprise this much, because Jerry did an excellent job of the problem. We have people on this campus who are wedded to paper and who believe that legitimate information comes in this form. It's three-dimensional, and this is real. Everything else is a gimmick. And all attempts to rationalize their information system are viewed as attacks on something sacred. On the other hand, we have techno cow people on this faculty. People who believe that this is a shining ornament of the past, that this belongs at a Society for Creative Acronism, an acronym meeting, that the book has no place. They're both out there. And interestingly enough, they're both in positions of power. Now, the book people are clearly in the decline on this issue, but they are there, and they believe it strongly. And they believe it with passion. The techno people on the other side believe with a passion in the future and believe in the possibility of cutting out some of the parts from the past that did cost money and did take time. And that's part of that is Berkeley. Part of that is we will never resolve. I often think what it would be like if we had chancellors like we had 50 and 60 years ago. Because I had the opportunity last summer, for reasons too bizarre to recount, I reviewed Kevin Starr's entire history of California. You know why? Because a judge wanted me to. When you talk about law and you get the different counselors, I mean, a powerful judge said, I'd really like to see these books reviewed, and I think Baring ought to review them. So I did. But it was fantastic. It was very educational and very interesting. But if you looked in that book, and I mean, if you read there and see the developments over time, and you could see how people seek cheap solutions to problems. And technology is a real problem on that score because it can be viewed as a cheap solution. We can eliminate everything else. We don't need things because it's all going to be end user delivered to the desktop of the student who's plugged into the wall of the dorm. You know, so that's part of Berkeley. That's part of Berkeley. And I have been here long enough to see the changes in the waves and the yins and the yangs as they come through, but we're going to have to live with that. What's the third premise? The third premise is something that we just have to keep in mind, and I know I depress my friends and annoy my family with this, but it's true. These are very good times. I have been here in very bad times. I have seen what it's like when there has been cut after cut from the legislature. I've watched the university, but at the law school, we are now, you know, way less than 50% funded by the state. I've watched as the public money has dried up, but we are now so flush. We will look back on these, I believe, as the good old days. These are the great days. So these are the times when we have to be planning well. These are the times when we have to be taking advantage of the situations that are presented to us. And that all of those initiatives that my two predecessors have discussed are attempts to do that. But I don't think we can divorce ourselves from recognizing the economy, just like the first of my three things, the culture, is outside of our control. There's nothing we're going to be able to do about that. If the stock market revs itself, if the IPOs continue for another 5 years, that means we have five really good years of planning. If everything crashes in March, or if there's a significant hiccup, then we will be put upon to change completely how we approach things. But the realities of the students as consumers and the realities of the faculty and their needs on this wide range is not going to change. We will still be put upon to solve the problem. So with those three premises, I want to talk about librarians on the campus and the role that librarians played. Let me just throw out a few observations, and then I really do want to get to the questions period, because I have a feeling that there's a lot of really good questions out there. I'm going to now go to the reminiscing part of the talk. I did come here 18 years ago. And when I came here 18 years ago, what did I find in my office? I found a Selectric typewriter. I was very pleased. If I want to sound like my grandfather, I can talk to my sons about how I worked my way through college and law school, one of my jobs being typing other people's papers. And of course, my sons respond, well, why would someone want you to type their papers? And I said, because you used to have to get it exactly right. And the worst moments of my life from college would be on the last line of the page screwing up because many of the professors wouldn't let you use erasable bond. You know, now why is that? I mean, love my colleagues. You know, don't use erasable bond. And then that fantastic development of liquid paper. Well, that's just reminiscing deeply here. But to my kids, this makes no sense at all. Why not just run a spell check and reformat? You know, what, they couldn't use their toolbar? So I found a Selectric typewriter. I found a telephone. Okay. If I went out into the lobby of the law library, there was a Lexis terminal. They were there then. Not very popular. Not very easy to use. Gigantic, clunky, sort of, they looked like the isolation booth on an old quiz show you had to get into. But it was the beginning of penetration by the market. And in law, in my kind of library, the market penetration came much faster. And it did come. Now, why do I mention the Selectric typewriter was my means of producing information. That's how I used to write. The telephone was my means of communication. That's how I used to call people. And one of the things we talked about on the staff was, are we allowed to make long-distance phone calls to other libraries to find information? If we need something from Maine, can we actually call a library in Portland, Maine, and ask them? And one of my great innovations was yes. We'll pay the long-distance phone bill. Call them. Now, if you go into my office, what would you find in my office? I have a very nice PC. And what do I do on that? It's replaced the telephone for me because I talk to most people. I was on at 6:30 this morning talking to people. via my computer. But it's more than my telephone. It's also my typewriter. It produces my information. And it's also my Lexis and Westlaw terminal, because I don't have to go to a terminal anymore. It comes to me. And it's also my source of information. I can pull down a terrific amount of information using some of the things that Jack and Jerry described. I can also buy things. I can sell things. It has replaced all of these systems. And at some point, the information infrastructure on the campus got divorced out of the sort of telecommunications structure on the campus. I got in a lot of trouble when I said in that California Monthly article that when people said you look at the library budget, I said you ought to look at the entire information budget. You ought to look at what it costs to build the information infrastructure. You ought to look at what it costs to run the telecommunications systems. You ought to look at all of the initiatives around campus. Because what you'd find is we've invested an enormous amount of money. And that 20 years ago probably would have been money you thought of as going through the library. It was information provision. There was a different set of people who ran the communications network, which at the time was telephones. But now that has become muddled in the public consciousness, and it's one of our big problems. And if you listen to all these initiatives, it's sorting out who does what and who is going to handle what. And again, the students don't care. They just want what they want, and they want more of it, and they want it now. But it's a huge problem that we face. I think we have an enormous asset right here. I think that Jerry brings a vision to what he does. I think he understands what's going on. I think, I'm going to mix my metaphors here. I already used Chinese court life. I've often thought of this campus as being feudal. And in the feudal life of this campus, the professors are the nobles. You know, they're noble people. And the students who come in, especially the graduate students, you know, are the apprentice nobles. They're being trained to be knights. And then the undergraduates are sort of the pages who run around, and some of them will be knights and some won't. And I always thought of the librarians as being part of the staff. Because librarians weren't admitted. And you know, over the years, since I've been here, librarians have been more and more divorced from the academic series. And you know, we are different. Well, what are we? We're the loyal retainers. We've been the bunters. We've been the Jeeves. We've been the people who showed up and helped out and were there and handing things. But we need a knight fighting for us. And I think Jerry has taken on that mantle. I think we now have someone with a sword out there on the field of battle. I think it's charming. I think it's charming he's still being introduced as the recently appointed. That's got to be about the last time you're going to get that. But the honeymoon is still on, but I think he's got the lay of the land. I think we've got someone out there who can fight for us. So that's number one. The number two thing that we have to keep in mind is, and I'm now going to speak to the librarians here. If you listen to the presentations, one of the things that you almost heard nothing of was human-to-human contact and mediation of information. That is what we've always done. I mean, in the old model of the university, whether we were Jeeves or Bunter or whatever we were crucial because faculty depended upon us to get them what they wanted. And maybe they were all Johnny Roccos forever. They wanted what they wanted. They wanted more of it. That's what the students wanted. We have been striving from our own positions of strength to provide that mediation of information. And I think that's where we have to continue to press. Those of you who know me know that at the law library, we've continued to put a large stress on reference services, on interpersonal contact, on keeping all members of the library involved in working with and being personified for the faculty for whom they work. I think that the presence of a human face between all of the initiatives that were described, many of which I didn't even know about. I mean, I learned a lot this morning. What could our faculties know about this? What do the students know about this? I believe we still need human beings involved in the process. And in fact, I think we need them even more. The need for an individual who knows how to work with people, who understands the architecture of information, perhaps not the telecommunications technology, but understands how information fits together and works, is absolutely crucial. For a long time, we could play a useful role by defending these, by buying books, by putting them on shelves, by keeping them available. We could pick on popular books. We could guess for the future. We still have to do that on this campus. The unfair part is that we have to do more, and we have to do different things. But the different things we do, the explanation of systems, the introduction of systems, the training and the use of systems, I see that as a human enterprise. Now, maybe that form of exchange will change. Maybe if we have this program 10 years from now, you won't even be here. Maybe you'll be at home, slipping a chip behind your ear, and we'll all be having a virtual experience, sitting in the room, and I'll be up here saying, you know, I've been here 28 years. And 10 years ago, you would have all had to actually come to a room, you know, and people will go, oh, my God, didn't everybody get the flu? Oh, yeah. Incredible waste of human time, and I'll figure out how much each, you know, the hours out of the day you actually had just walking to and from. That might happen, but even if it does, I still think you need a human mediating, authenticating information, training in systems, and making choices. The saddest part of the talk that preceded me was the issue that I'll end with, and this is an issue Jerry faces, and I think the university faces, we as a profession face, but the saddest part was talking about getting IT professionals' salaries to a point where they can compete with the private sector. Because, I mean, the librarians on the campus have long been undercompensated, understatused, but it's now becoming, in my profession, in my segment, law librarianship, which is a privileged section in the profession, because we have a lot of people, because of their experience and their double degrees, get paid more. So we've always been at the high end of library compensation. Directors are now facing the fact we can't attract very many people into the field anymore. We don't pay enough. We pay about one half or less of what a new graduating law student makes. And it's very hard to get a person who's had even more training to come into that field. This has always been a problem in our field. I'll do one anecdote, then I'll quit. And that is, I will always remember my conversation with my father. Some of you who've heard me over the years have heard this, but it's true. When I told my father, who was a working man, who reverenced education, and I was the one who got to go off to college, and I went to this fancy law school and went to library school. And he visited me when I clerked in New York City, and he came to the law firm I worked at, and he was amazed. He used to say, what do all these guys do? Go to these buildings in suits. What do they do? And they make money, Dad. And they offered me a job. He knew that. They offered me a job in New York City, and I decided I didn't want to do that. I wanted to finish my library degree and be a law librarian. And this is my, on the phone, my father said, look, I know you're smart and I'm stupid, which was always a good opener between us. And he said, but you want to be a librarian? Is that right? And I said, that's right. He said, so now you got this job in New York where they'll pay you more money to start than I ever made my whole life. And I said, I know, life is not fair. It's so unfair that that would happen. He said, but you don't want that job. I said, no, actually, I don't want that job. He said, and they don't, like, beat you or anything at this job, right? You actually kind of like some of those guys. And I said, well, yeah, some of them are pretty nice guys. Said, but you don't want that either. You want to go back and get another degree so you could go get a job you don't even know you have yet, but you do know it'll pay you a lot less than this job you don't want now. And then I went through the whole thing about fulfillment. Dad, you know, I want to do something I feel good about. I really want to help people. I want to be involved in the competitive information. I want to be involved in helping folks out. And at the end of it, he said, you think when I first took my job at the mill, I went down there for fulfillment? That's why they pay you, moron. So it was an issue then, but it's so much bigger issue now. I mean, and we, you know, we've got the existing folks and the existing infrastructure and a desire for economy. But I think somebody, and I'm hoping that Jerry will play a role in this, but it's got to be bigger than that, takes a serious look at the library, almost from a zero-based position, and goes back and sees what levels of compensation are needed, and sees how to hold people and how to attract people into this system. Because we need good mediators of information. None of this is going to work without the librarians. Thanks.
Well, thank you for three very interesting presentations. Now it's our question period. Anybody who has a question, please direct your question to me, but you can direct it also to whoever you would like to ask a question of, and I will recognize you. Questions? Mari.
I'd like to ask Jeff to talk a little bit about a new proposal for educational development and technology. Is that in process, what's happening with that?
Could you clarify that one a little bit? I didn't quite hear which part of it. Oh, okay. Yes. I'm a little weak on this one because I haven't dealt with it recently. Alice Agagino has spent the last 6 months working as a faculty assistant with Carol, trying to look at what we really need to pull together on the campus to try to integrate a lot of these educational technology activities that Jerry and I were lamenting are uncoordinated and not directed and so on. A specific proposal has come out of that for a teaching and learning center on campus that would pull together several of the activities, such as the GSI training I think she proposes in there, and the instructional technology program that was a part of IS&T, and several other units that are delivering specific pieces, but to form a essentially an institute type of activity that would really focus on teaching and learning in general and how the appropriate way of using technology in that process is.